Welcome to Betting 360, your number one source for horse racing and sports betting insights. Coming around the bend is your host, David Duffield, with another expert interview to give you the winning edge.
Hi, this is David Duffield, and welcome to another episode of the Betting 360 podcast. My special guest today is Dan Weston. He runs the website tennisratings.co.uk, and he's going to give us some really good pointers on how to find value in tennis betting. So with the Australian Open starting shortly, there's some players that he thinks are a reasonable value, and also some outsiders that are a big value, and then there's a few that he thinks are under the odds as well, a couple in one particular that is worth laying. So he'll run through what he thinks is important when you're doing the form, so to speak, for tennis, and how you might be able to get a decent edge betting on the Australian Open. So let's have a chat with Dan. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to join you.
Yeah, look forward to learning a bit more about tennis betting. It's obviously the time of season here where a lot of Australian punters get into it a lot more so than for the rest of the year. So speaking specifically of the Australian Open, what should punters be aware of? What's unique to either the surface or even just Grand Slams versus the regular tour?
Okay, well, the first thing that I would really recommend bettors and punters looking at is the different facets between the men's and the women's format in the Australian Open and all Grand Slams, actually. It's quite an underestimated area is the five-set nature of the men's as opposed to the typical three-set nature of the ATP tour and also, obviously, the women's tour full stop. The effect of five-set matches, it cannot be underestimated. I've written an article about it already showing the very poor record that players tend to have, especially lower ranked players, after playing a five set match in the previous, after winning a five set match in the previous round. So it's the accumulated fatigue that can be incurred by playing various five set matches is not a positive thing for a player, and that's something that you need to look at. And there's certain players as well with poor records, for example, in third sets. Some players on the top of my head that I can think of: Jack Sock, Martin Krizan, Julian Beneteau, who have got awful third set records. That doesn't lend themselves to playing long 4-5 set matches either. So they're particularly players that I'd look to maybe give a swerve to in a Grand Slam match.
Okay, and regarding five sets, he's saying that there can be the recovery issue, but also does form hold a little bit truer in the fact that they are five set matches? There's less upsets?
Well, that is historically true, that favourites are much more favoured in Grand Slams than at any other point. Data that I've got gives about 76-77% favourite win percentage in Grand Slams. That compares to about 70% in Masters and 500 events in the ATP. And that drops actually to about 63% in 250s. So you can see that there's quite a big advantage for favourites in Grand Slams, because obviously it's a bit like a snooker match, really. The best of nine in a snooker match is a lot more prone to causing upsets. Whereas when you play the World Championships, the Crucible, it's like best of 25 or whatever. That does favour the better player who tends to come through in the long run. And also the better players in tennis tend to be a lot fitter as well. So they might go like two sets down or two sets to one down and then power through the fourth and fifth set because of their superior fitness and mental strength as well.
It sounds a little bit like T20 versus Test cricket as well. You can have a lot more upsets in T20 as opposed to the five-day version.
Yeah.
So with you mentioned that the strike rate's there and there's less unpredictability in the Grand Slam matches, is that already factored into the market? Is there still some value there, or is it people, it's so well known that really there's no profitable edge there?
It is well known that favourites do thrive in men's Grand Slams, but and it is factored into the price, definitely to some extent. Favourites, especially in the opening rounds, tend to be priced prohibitively short. I'm talking sub 1.2 or less, which is obviously 5-1 on or shorter, which it's not really great for a casual punter who's looking to get a bigger price. There are opportunities that obviously exist from that. Some favourites tend to start slower, so then perhaps I might look to lay them pre-match with a view to backing them at bigger prices later on, like a later back position. Or the difference then comes towards the women's, because the women's favourites tend to be priced quite short as well. But because it's a three-set format, favourites don't tend to thrive as much. So a lot of the time there's some more value on underdogs in the women's because of that.
Okay, and what is your approach in, I suppose, in general terms? Is it heavily stats-based and data-driven?
Yeah, absolutely. It's 100% quantitative stats-based. I don't really take into account any form of opinion because it's not absolute. I look at stats primarily and solely, really, as my guide. So what I'll do to start a match is I'll price it up based on the basic service and break percentages for each player, which then creates a projected hold. And then I base the projected holds of the two players according to my model, which creates a basic starting price. And then I adjust it for matchup issues. You know, for the sake of argument, player X might struggle against the left-hander or a big server. I'll take that into account, head-to-head record, although I don't tend to take head-to-head records into account as much as a lot of other people do. I find it quite overrated by the media, find it quite lazy journalism, if you will, by the written and TV media who tend to trot it out quite a lot, thinking that a 1-0 or 2-1 or 2-0 head-to-head record is absolute and a big advantage. Well, it's not, especially if it's over 2 years old and on different surfaces. I'm looking, when I say a head-to-head record, I might take into account it'll be like a 3-0 that's within 2 years all on the same surface, or 2 out of 3 on the same surface, or 4-0 or more dominantly, when I might be more happy to take a longer period of time or on different surfaces. But a really dominant head-to-head is what I'm looking at, rather than like a 1-0 or a 2-0.
Yeah, and you're talking about small sample sizes there as well. Sure. Only played a couple of times. So with the break and the hold percentages, is that you weigh that more heavily, their recent record?
Yeah, I look at all stats within the last 12 months, the rolling 12-month stat. I won't look any further than that unless there's just not enough sample size. And then I'm going to be quite reticent to get hugely involved in it from a financial point of view based on the fact that I'm using older data as well. So the stakes will be a lot smaller, or might just give the match a swerve full stop. Regarding sample sizes, I want a player to ideally have played 15 matches on that surface in the last year to get a reasonable guide on how accurate their service hold and break percentages might be. Because obviously, whilst 15 matches doesn't sound that much, that's a fair proportion, probably over 100 service and return games. So it's becoming more of an accurate percentage on that basis.
Yeah, so I was just going to ask, so you mentioned the amount of matches on particular surface. Mm-hmm. What is your breakdown or category types for the number of different surfaces out there? Because I'm sure it must vary a lot throughout the ATP season.
Yeah. I mean, hard and indoor hard is quite difficult to differentiate because there's not a huge amount of indoor hard tournaments, especially in the women's tour. So I will lump them together if I have to, but I prefer not to. I won't look at hard or indoor hard form at all with regards to clay, because I find a completely different surface. Obviously, there's a lot of clay court specialists who aren't good at hard courts, and to some extent vice versa as well. Some hard courters who really aren't good at on clay. I mean, Andy Roddick was a prime example before he retired. One, an Australian guy for you, Matosevic, who's pretty similar in that respect, and obviously not nearly at the level of Roddick ever was, but an example of that nonetheless. Marcos Baghdatis is another one as well. So I won't look at the hard courts that's at all regarding clay. That's a completely separate entity, and I'll treat that as such. Grass is difficult because there's not a huge sample size on grass. It's only a month out of the year calendar is grass. Most players only play one or two warm-up events plus Wimbledon. So it's hard to get a statistical sample. So I might have to go a bit longer in data size for that, like as in go back to say 2012 as well as 2013 when I'm looking at 2014 grass data. It's not ideal, but I try and factor in the potential improvement of a player as well during that time. So I might see how the overall service hold and break have either improved or declined in that time period, and then try and relate it to their grass stats, if that makes sense.
Yep. And what other stats do you consider important? Because you mentioned, you know, a couple of the fairly well-known ones, but what else would you factor into the model?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there's the head-to-head record, I try and quantify it. What I did was I went through all the previous data and worked out the return on investment for various different scenarios and built that in. There's other things that I quantify and build into my model. One thing that I think is hugely underrated by the betting market is travelling and condition of a player. So I kind of touched on that earlier a bit with regard to the five sets in the men's game in the Grand Slams, but one thing that people don't tend to appreciate is the accumulated fatigue that's brought up in a typical tournament of three sets. So I'm looking at players who have played two or more three-set matches, which have either gone a long duration, such as, you know, 2.5 hours plus, preferably even over three, and it's quite rare, or over 30 games in duration. So I found that playing two 30-game plus three-set matches over in the same tournament and winning both of them, playing a subsequent round, had a very poor return when backing that player in the next match. So I might look to oppose that player, and that's all factored into the model as well. And there's some players as well who also don't perform well after playing three-set matches, just based on a fitness level as well. So when I know those sorts of players, I'll factor that into the model. And also there's another underestimated area is travel. But you've got a situation coming up next week where players will be travelling from Chennai, which is in the current calendar this week, to another tournament in Australia. I remember Benoit Paire last year. He got to the semi-finals of Chennai and flew over and gave an abysmal effort in the next round. In the first round of the tournament in Australia the subsequent week, because of the travel duration and time zone adjustments that are needed to be adjusted to in a short space of time. So typically, semi-final of the Chennai event might be played on a Saturday, and he might be required to play the first round match of a tournament in Australia on the Monday. So effectively, he's got sub 48 hours to fly from India to Australia and adjust to a number of hours time zone difference. So what I look at is players who have played the week previously in a tournament, flown say 6 hours plus, gone through say four or five plus hour time zone differences, and then are playing a first round match real quick the next week, and I found that has a very negative effect on their chances as well. And that's the sort of thing that I would build into a model as well. So I know the return on investment involved in that scenario, and then that's quantified into my model as well.
I was going to ask that. What you say there makes perfect sense, but how do you then quantify it in a model, and how do you know, I suppose, the threshold that, because the guys are used to travelling, or the women as well, but how do you know what the red zone is as far as travel and fatigue?
What I do is I draw the line at a quarter final match. So anyone who plays a quarter final or later, So that, because the quarterfinals played on the Friday, and then they have to play a match on the Monday or Tuesday. They're the ones that I'll include in that. So what I did was I went through all the past data, which is pretty much what I do with every different scenario, and work out the return on investment over a decent sample. And from that basis, I can then adjust my basic model price based on the given negative or positive return on investment that was generated from that analysis.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I know you do a lot of in-play trading. It's not as well suited, unfortunately, because most of the listeners are Australian, and we've got some a pretty archaic law that says we need to phone up. But just maybe briefly touch on some of the opportunities in-play.
Okay, well, I personally do really, really like in-play betting and trading, and I feel that it gives more opportunities than pre-match betting for several reasons. First of all, there's a lack of in-play data because it's quite hard to come across and hard to process, very time-consuming. By in-play data, I'm talking things like the percentage of times that a player might get broken when they're leading by a break, so they lose their break advantage, which creates a great swing trading opportunity. And on the flip side, how often they might recover a break deficit when they break down. And believe it or not, there's quite a few players who do excel in various scenarios that you wouldn't quite expect them to, so they're quite underestimated by the market. And there's other various in-play data that you can look at, so for example, how often a player might get broken in their first two service games of a set, how often they might get broken in the latter games of a set, which is all really crucial facets to in-play trading. That having that data is so invaluable for me, and having to create it myself means that there's not much availability on the market, so I've kind of got a really, really nice edge in that area. Whereas obviously pre-match data is a lot more prevalent in the marketplace. There's various websites that have got great pre-match data, and it's a lot easier to price up a match pre-match based on the availability of data compared to in-play. Secondly, in-play, the market can be quite irrational. There's quite a lot of irrational decision-making because of the lack of data and impulsive decisions that they have to make on a very, you know, they've got to make decisions very quickly. Examples of that is when a player has medical timeout and the market often overreacts and, fearing a retirement, starts backing the fit player, so to speak, whilst the player has a medical timeout. But if that player recovers from a medical timeout, the price can often really fluctuate back up. So I do find that the irrationality of laying the injured player really heavily tends to give advantages. When that player comes back on court, if they can recover from the injury, then that can give some quite good edges to me. Remember a match last year, I think it was Bartoli v Toro Floor, I can't remember where it was, but it was in the clay season, and Bartoli turned her ankle, if I recall correctly, and Toro Floor went down to about 1.05, which fractionally speaking is about 20-1 on, and Bartoli came back on court and ended up winning the match, and even after several points, her price had just gone up so much. So the opportunities are there, and that was all due to the irrationality and fear that Bartoli was going to retire. And kind of related to those two points where I said about the lack of in-play data and the irrational decision-making that people have in play, it's harder to prepare. So what I do in a match, prior to a match, is to create a trading script. So I've got all the data in front of me before the match starts, and then I can react to the different situations with quantitative data as it happens, instead of making subjective and irrational decisions. So I find that gives me a bigger edge over the market than pre-match, where people can sort of take their time to assess the different situations pre-match.
Yeah, and I've seen the script, and again, it makes sense to be prepared. Nothing sure. Not much that you can see there is unexpected. You've mapped out the scenarios and what the likelihood is following that type of scenario. So, yeah, I suggest people take a look at the website for the scripts. There's tips themselves. There's minimum prices. There's daily spreadsheets. There's in-play and trading handbooks. So there's plenty to go through there on the site, so people should check it out. But just to finish up with, it is the Australian Open is the highlight of the local calendar. What would stand out, and we're a couple of weeks away at this stage, what would stand out as a reasonable value bet either on the men's or the women's side at this stage, a player or two you think might be undervalued at the moment?
Okay, it's clear to see from the stats that the favourites are justified. Both Novak Djokovic and Serena Williams are the best players in the field on the surface at this current time. So It's hard to argue against their status. Djokovic looked absolutely superb at the end of last season. He won his last 24 matches in a row, and he had a real big edge over Nadal, who obviously he's seeded to face in the final. So men's-wise, it's hard to look past Djokovic, and women's-wise, Serena Williams is so dominant generally, especially with Sharapova coming back from shoulder injury and Azarenka losing five out of her last six matches last season. It's difficult to see her getting beaten as well. So I think you can get just over 3-1 on the double, which I wouldn't discourage at all. Regarding outsiders, as I said previously, favourites do tend to get the results in Grand Slams. So it's hard to see someone coming completely from left field and getting to the semi-finals or the final. I think something like 20, 26 or 28 players from each tour have got to the final when they've been ranked in the top 10 in the last 10 years. 85-90% of players in the Australian Open final who have in the final have been ranked in the top 10, and pretty much mostly in the top 5. Left field bets, I like Ernest Gulbis. I think he's probably about 200 and something to 1. At the moment, with a view to maybe trading his position if he gets to the, say, quarterfinals or maybe even the semifinals. He's got some really good service hold and break stats on hard court, which rank him around the top 10. And he tends to have a very because he's quite a blasé player who doesn't seem to get phased when he plays against top players. He gave Nadal a superb match last season and really doesn't get overawed against top players. He beat Andy Murray as well. So he's someone I'd look at with a view to backing at a very big price and then perhaps laying off at a latter stage. Regarding big servers, I'm not a big fan of them in Grand Slam. So the likes of Raonic, John Isner, not for me, because of the accumulative fatigue that they incur by playing long matches because they don't break enough. So they're players that I definitely would rule out from a long-term position. But I say Gorbis for me. Men's-wise, I don't like the likes of Del Potro because he doesn't break serve enough, and that's a problem that Tsonga has as well. Federer's getting too old, but still always a threat. But he's lost his last seven against Nadal and Djokovic combined, which doesn't bode well. And obviously Andy Murray is recovering from surgery himself, so it's a bit sort of touch and go as to how he might get on. Looking at the women's left field positions, where Simona Halep had a great season last year. She won six titles. Generally low caliber events though, but she's got some great hole break stats, and which definitely put her in the top 10. I can really see her making inroads into the top 10 this year because she hasn't got many points to defend until May sort of time, and she's ranked 11th at the moment. So I'd be very surprised if we don't see her in the top 10 pretty soon. I think she's around about 50-1 at the moment. It's difficult to see many women getting to the business end of the tournament because they lack a lot of mental strength. I know Lee Nar has got to the final couple of times in Australia, but her record in finals generally is very poor, and Agnieszka Radwanska just doesn't have the stats to back up any claims to get to the final. I think she's about 33-1, I think, at the moment. And also, she's only got to one Grand Slam final, so she hasn't really got a great track record in Grand Slams. There's not a great deal that stands out in the women's, but I say Halep's a solid choice. I'd much rather back someone like Halep than Petra Kvitova, who's available at a shorter price, but who played 50% of three-set matches last season, which puts her in a lot of danger, not only from the accumulative fatigue that I've spoken about several times, but also, obviously, playing a shootout third set, it doesn't put her in the best situations. And she doesn't break serve enough as well. I've got stats where she's only broken serve 37.7% of the time across all surfaces in 2013, which is pretty much bang on the WTA average. So for her to be ranked like fifth favourite for the tournament, only breaking serve average is not for me at all. I think she's about 18-19-1. That's not for me either. So for me, Halep is an outsider, but Serena Williams definitely looks to be the player to beat. Although, obviously, it is worth noting that she hasn't performed well in recent previous years, in the last 2 years, losing to Sloane Stephens last year and Nakarova in 2012. So I guess she's vulnerable in terms of historically, but statistically, no. She's by far and away the best player in WTA right now.
Interesting. Really appreciate that, Dan, and may have been your debut on the show today, but I think we'll get you on for each of the Grand Slams if you're happy to accommodate.
Absolutely. I'd really like that. It'd be great.
Excellent. All right. Good luck for the tournament yourself, and good luck to everyone listening. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to Betting 360. Get more in-depth analysis, tips, and that betting edge by heading over to championpicks.com.au, where you'll find a full transcript of this episode. If you like the show, share us with a fellow punter or drop by iTunes to leave us your thoughts. Betting 360, punting from all angles.